WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When I interview an actor or director, I often turn to David Thompson's Biographical Dictionary of Film. It not only has basic biographical information, it offers Thompson's critical observations of the person's work. Thompson describes the book as personal, opinionated, and obsessive. He cautions that within nearly every entry, there are things that may be startling in a biographical dictionary. The sharp expression of personal taste, jokes, digressions, insults, and eulogies. The first edition of Thompson's Biographical Dictionary was published 25 years ago. A new edition has just been published. Thompson was born in London and now lives in San Francisco. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times, Salon, Film Comment, and The Independent in London. He's also the author of three novels and a biography of producer David O. Selznick. I asked David Thompson for an example of an entry in his biographical dictionary that many readers have disagreed with.
Well, there are many people I have known and many women I have known who have found my adoration for Angie Dickinson far-fetched. They're not sure whether I'm teasing or whether I really mean it, and I'm here to tell you that I do mean it. I think that in the 1950s particularly and in the 1960s, she was an extraordinary actress, and I'm deeply fond of her. I've never met her. But everything I say about her is sincere and heartfelt. I think everything in the book is heartfelt, although sometimes I think one needs to tease people a bit. And I always understood that saying Angie Dickinson was a great actress would make people laugh, but laughter sometimes is a prelude to thought.
Now, Cary Grant, you've described him as the most fascinating male personality in pictures. Why do you give him that prized spot?
Well, it's a complicated thing. I'll be as brief as I can about it. I think, essentially, it comes to this, that Grant could go from lightness and humor and charm and being incredibly attractive to being dark, secretive, selfish, unpleasant, and he could do it in a moment. He could do it in a beat. And I think in a way it's that kind of ease of transition that makes the most interesting people in films, to do it without going through immense antics of acting with quotes around it, but just to let your being shift. And for years Grant was regarded as simply a movie star. I think, again, people have come to realize that in so many ways he's a very uneasy figure. We sort of take for granted now that he was very uneasy sexually. I think he was very uneasy with his fame. I think he was uneasy with being a hero and all of those things. And in his best work, and that's often the work for people like Hitchcock and Hawks, because he did his best with the great directors, I think you see that really volatile, uneasy personality.
Okay, I'm going to flip to your entry for Jane Mansfield. You describe her as the swan song of pre-nude sexuality in films. Explain what you mean.
Well, Jane Mansfield had her brief glory in an age when women on screen could not really quite take their clothes off. They could give you the indication that they were prepared to, and they could often be startlingly close to being naked. There was even a film, I think, once where Mansfield was naked for a few frames, and they had to paint in something to cover her nipples. She was intensely suggestive. And in the film she made with Frank Tashlin, who was a cartoonist who had turned into a filmmaker, nearly a forgotten figure today, she was a cartoon figure. I think, in fact, she was a good deal more intelligent than she ever appeared on screen, and I'm sure she was horribly burdened by having this immensely voluptuous body. But, within 5-10 years of Mansfield's glory, It was very common for actresses to take off their clothes and for sexuality on screen to have reached into far more intimate and allegedly daring situations. I'm not sure that that's always true, but she is. She and Marilyn Monroe are sort of near contemporaries, late 50s, early 60s, and they're beautiful examples of just before censorship was going to crack.
Who is one of your favorite actresses working today?
Well, I have to say that I like Nicole Kidman more and more with almost every film I see. She's someone who, I think, in the space of 10 years has become her own woman. I think she's made amazing career choices. One of the things you face when you do a book like this is that as well as artistic careers, people have professional careers, and in most cases they're only aware of a professional career. And some people make very bad choices. They just pick the wrong films, and you can see their career turning to ashes and sadness. I mean, I would say that, for instance, Michelle Pfeiffer has made a lot of bad choices. I don't know why, but I think she has. Nicole Kidman, it seems to me, and she's obviously had big pressures on her life of one kind or another. Nicole Kidman has made choices that I just think enlarge our sense of her and enlarge her craft all the time. There is a film coming out at the end of this year, just after Christmas, where she plays Virginia Woolf. Now, once upon a time, the idea of this young, very Australian woman playing Virginia Woolf, a kind of archetypal figure of Bloomsbury culture, might have been thought ridiculous. I think people will be amazed at how good she is in that role. So she's someone I really admire very much.
David Thompson is my guest, and he has a new edition of his biographical dictionary of film. I'm going to ask you to turn to the entry for the director, James Toback, the director and screenwriter, and I'm asking you to do this because he is a friend of yours, and for our listeners who don't know his movies include Fingers and The Pickup Artist. Name some other of his movies.
Harvard Man was the most recent, Black and White, Exposed, Love and Money, The Big Bang, Two Girls and a Guy.
Good. So this is you writing about somebody who's a good friend of yours.
Yes.
But as we know, as we've heard, you write very opinionated, critical entries for everybody in your biographical dictionary. So read us an excerpt of what you've done for James Toback, your friend.
Dear Jim, you may not know it, but you are the best friend I feel obliged to include in this book. That may be a wretched position for both of us. You are also one of the friends I most value in life. I then go on and I quote what was an original review of his first film, Fingers, which opened in 78, and which I reviewed as critic on the Real Paper in Boston. And now, picking up. Anyway, our friendship began a few days after this review ran, and it lasts, I hope. Have you known or guessed that I've never liked anything of yours quite as much, or nearly as much, since? Have we betrayed each other? Is it possible for a movie maker and a critic to be friends?
Well, let me ask you that question. Is it possible for a critic and a movie maker to be friends?
It's extraordinarily difficult, and it requires enormous tolerance and openness on both parts. And I would have to say that on Jim's part, and Jim and I haven't spoken for a few months, and I think he knows it's because I didn't like Harvard Man. So again, I'm sending a kind of letter to him over the air. I think it depends upon his generosity, and to me he has been an extraordinary, compulsive friend, someone I could never dream of giving up. But it's very, very difficult if you're a critic, because sooner or later the critic is going to offend the filmmaker, I think, and vice versa. And in the decades over which I've done this book, I've come to know many more people in the book. When I began the book, I don't think I had met more than two or three people who were in the book. I've probably met a couple of hundred now who are in the book. And some of them don't talk to me anymore. Some of them have become even friendlier, and I have to wonder whether that's because I happen to like them. It puts friendship to a very, very great test. But I do think that anyone in the arts knows this dilemma, and you have to make up your mind how far flattery and the critical spirit, how much those two things mean to you. And I try always to tell people what I think about their films.
My guest is David Thompson. He has a new edition of his Biographical Dictionary of Film. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Thompson. He has a new edition of his Biographical Dictionary of Film. You know, some people get into making movies or writing about movies because they love the magic of movies, and part of that magic is like the stars who make the movies, and part of the thrill of it all is the opportunity to maybe get close to them and see what these people are really like. Of course, if you're a critic and you're going to be writing bad reviews of these people, as you know, it's not necessarily going to endear you to them. Was that ever part of what you wanted? Did you ever want writing about movies to be like your foot in the door to get to actually meet the people who make them?
Oh, yes, I think that was something. I mean, I was born and raised in England, and for a large part of my life, America and Hollywood were literally places that existed on a screen. And I fell in love with America through the screen, which is probably because I was lucky enough to be a kid watching American movies when they were pretty good, late 40s, early 50s, that time. I never dreamed I would come to America, much less go to Los Angeles. And I know when that began, when I began to sort of go on the sets and meet people, it was enormously exciting, but very frightening too, because it was really like stepping into a dream world. And it has probably filled me up for good. If I never stepped on another film set, I would not be upset now. But what it has done is leave me with a great desire and interest to write about the way business affects the art in American film, because I think still to this day that is not fully understood. The money is so powerful. I think there is literally a way in which even the great artists we might like to name in American film do it for the money. It's almost the only way to survive there. And I find that a fascinating subject, and I hope one day to write a book about that. But I've met enough actors and actresses by now, yeah.
We know you're talking about how money affects movie making. Years ago, I think it was in the 80s, you wrote an essay about why screenplays are so bad, and your answer to the question is, nobody reads them.
Hmm. Really, nobody reads in Hollywood at all. I mean, that is something that you learn when you do a book like this, which has some harsh things to say about certain people in Hollywood, and years later they will come up to you and embrace you and tell you it's a hell of a book, a terrific book, and they've not read it. And Hollywood is not a reading community, I think, on the whole. And I'm not sure that it ever was, but there was certainly a time when people wrote scripts to be read. There was a quality in the dialogue in them, for instance, that alone begged to be read, and begged to be read aloud sometimes. We don't have very many people left who can do dialogue like that.
Well, how can screenplays not be read if the screenplay is going to be made?
Because the screenplay is a concept. It's a package. And people will tell themselves, well, no need to read the screenplay yet because we're going to rewrite it anyway. What I need to know is the concept. And the concept is, let's say, Tom Cruise and Leonardo DiCaprio together, action film set in the South Pacific, we might bring it in for 110 million. Now, those are the vital things about the concept. If someone whispers in your ear, but you know the screenplay is really not very good yet, you say, well, don't worry. We'll doctor that. If it's a Tom Cruise film, Robert Towne probably will have a moment where he'll go over the script and he'll turn it smooth and he'll turn it into gold. No need to read the script yet. And it sounds like a preposterous and far-fetched notion, but I seriously mean it, that scripts are always changing. Sometimes a movie never has a finished script. And because of that, certain people feel they never need to actually read the script in detail. They will get coverage on it. They'll get reports on it. They'll ask other people what they think of the script. And there will be a sort of word-of-mouth estimate of the script that circulates around a film. But then next day you'll get new pages. So nobody settles on what the script really is or what they think of it.
You know, Todd Haynes has a new movie that I think is very good called Far From Heaven. And it's an homage to the movies of Douglas Sirk, who made the movies Magnificent Obsession, All That Heaven Allows, Written on the Wind, Imitation of Life. You have an interesting entry on Douglas Sirk in your biographical dictionary of film. Would you talk a little bit about what you see as Douglas Sirk's style and importance?
Well, Sirk was a very interesting figure. He had come out of German theater, and he came to America in the late 30s, and he gradually found his way to Universal, where in the 1950s he made a series of very successful what are called women's pictures, pictures with Rock Hudson, Jane Wyman, people like that in them. He was a great stylist. He loved color, he loved decor, he loved camera movement. And those people who just love film style for film style's sake adore Sirk and were in raptures, as I was when Far From Heaven unpeeled on the screen, because it isn't just a homage. It's as if Todd Haynes has become Douglas Sirk almost for a moment. It's just breathtakingly beautiful. The colors in the film are put together with a kind of boldness that really no one since Sirk or Michael Powell has dared to do.
We usually use the word melodrama in a very dismissive way, like, oh, it's just a melodrama. In your entry for Sirk, you sing the praises of melodrama and you write, long live melodrama and let us stress the quality of Douglas Sirk. What do you think of as melodrama? Like, what does melodrama mean to you and what was his approach to it? Yeah, go ahead.
I'll tell you what melodrama is. Melodrama is going in out of the daylight, paying money to sit in the dark, packed in by strangers so that you feel you can't get out, in front of a screen the size of an ocean liner, where the screen is filled with a tear dropping from a woman's blue eye down to her red mouth. That's melodrama. It's in the nature of the movies. It's sitting in front of a screen where you know that quicker than you can close your eyes, the image can change from, say, the one I've just described to an image of a knife tearing down that woman's cheek. It's the basic melodramatic condition of not knowing what's going to happen next and longing to find out. And so long as that lives, movies will live. When people feel they've seen it all before and therefore are not surprised, are not shocked, not delighted, not moved, and maybe we're there already, that's when movies are in danger of fading away, I think.
As a practicing critic yourself, what do you think of the state of film criticism today?
I'm not really what I would call a practicing critic. I don't,
because you don't review movies on a regular basis.
I don't review
right.
movies, and I don't think I'm actually good at it. Whenever I've done it briefly, it's not worked terribly well. I think I'm much better at thinking about movies over a period of time and then writing about them later. But to address your question, I think that we're in a bad, bad time for the movies, and I pray that there's a young generation coming. Sometimes you get the feeling that with the Andersons and people like that, Alexander Payne, Spike Jonze, there could be a really new tough, irreverent generation such as came into being in the 1970s in America. I hope that's going to happen. I would have to say, though, and I don't think I'm the only film writer or critic who would tell you this in honesty, that going to the movies all the time gets tougher.
But what about the state of film criticism?
I think film criticism barely has a state at the moment, I'm afraid to say. I think it's a reflection of the times. I think it's a reflection of a culture in which thumbs up or thumbs down has come to be the central way of relating to a movie. I think advertising, where you don't even know the names of the people being quoted, and it's no surprise to discover sometimes that some of them were invented. I think people feel extremely distant from film criticism, and it's been such a terrible falling off since the great days of Pauline Kael, who, whatever you think about her, she made film criticism central to the American intelligentsia. Don't think that obtains anymore, and it's a real sadness for those of us who have followed her.
David Thompson has just published a new edition of his biographical dictionary of film. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.